Is drug-induced mysticism really comparable to a classic mystical experience without the drugs? It's a question Stephanie Simon explores in her book, The Subtle Body, The Story of Yoga in America. It's a cultural history that cuts across an enormous swath of spiritual movements and recounts the stories of Aldous Huxley, Timothy Leary, and the Indian swamis who landed on American soil. Simon says today's scientific study of psychedelics could lead to new breakthroughs.
I think it's new in that they have learned the lessons of the 60s, and by that I mean the early 60s, when Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert were studying psychedelics at Harvard, supposedly scientifically, and they were doing very active research into the spiritual potential of psychedelics. But as many people remember, they were so passionate about their work and such engaged participants in psychedelics, and they were dropping acid and taking mushrooms, and their enthusiasm ended up stirring up more controversy than positive press, unfortunately, and led to them getting essentially fired from their positions at Harvard as social scientists. But it was really Aldous Huxley who brought the attention to the spiritual potential of psychedelics, and that really began actually in the early 50s.
Well, let's talk about that a little, because the historical perspective does matter. We tend to think of the 60s as the age of psychedelics, but it was, right, what, 1954 when Huxley published The Doors of Perception?
Yeah, exactly. He did mescaline and had this very powerful spiritual experience in which he said that he understood what all those Eastern texts meant. Finally, he had this sort of very visceral awakening, and he wrote about it in The Doors of Perception. He went on to publish in 1958 in the Saturday Evening Post a piece advocating psychedelics, what he would call mind-manifesting drugs, specifically because of their spiritual potential. And more than that, because they were a very democratic way of having mystical experiences and experiencing divinity. And he felt in 1958 that psychedelic drugs, or these mind-manifesting drugs, would bring about a religious revival, and he even went so far to call it a religious revolution.
You said he used psychedelics to explain his spiritual experiences. He had been a serious student. I mean, he was set up to take drugs in a way that perhaps many other people weren't.
Yes, he had been a student of Indian thought, Eastern wisdom, for many years. He was a pacifist during World War II, and Vedanta had been a major theme in helping him explain and rationalize his beliefs, Vedanta being Indian philosophy that posits monism, which is the oneness of the universe, and, you know, makes the search for unity with God or divinity its main purpose. And he was, you know, philosophically a perennialist. He felt that all religions had that message, but he really leaned towards Vedanta and Zen and those sorts of philosophies that really talked about divinizing your reality and that this was possible in this life. It wasn't just for the afterlife.
One of the interesting things about looking at Huxley's experience is that he did have that spiritual background before that. And that wasn't true of all who took drugs, certainly in the 60s. And it raises the question, doesn't it? Is it important for people to have some spiritual training before they take psychedelics? Or is it enough to just have a mind-blowing experience without any preparation?
That was actually the big shift in the 60s, which was that the first generation, which included Huxley and people like Christopher Isherwood and people in that circle in Los Angeles in the 50s and early 60s, they had, as you said, came with this sort of spiritual training of a sort, or at least a pretty deep knowledge. That's how they got to psychedelics. In the 60s, with all the young people dropping acid and doing mushrooms, they actually did the reverse. They took the acid, had these mind-blowing experiences, and then worked their way over to yoga often, or other types of Eastern mysticism, but very often yoga. And so the drugs led them to other forms of spiritual experience.
Were they searching for an explanation of the experience they had?
I think it went a couple of different ways. One, they certainly were searching to make sense of their trips. There was a guy named Arthur Kleps who did a tremendous amount of acid, actually accidentally, up in Millbrook in the 60s, and went out of his mind, went a little bit crazy. And later he read a very famous book on Tantra by Arthur Avalon, which is a pseudonym for Sir John Woodruff and his collaborator. And he literally said, this is what happened to me. The experience of Kundalini rising described in this tantric book is exactly what happened to me on acid. So it made sense of his trip. Other people essentially burnt out on psychedelics, and yoga was very available by the late 60s. And so people like Srila Prabhupada, who headed up the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, most people know him as the head of the Hare Krishnas, he and also Maharshi Mahesh, who's the kind of originator of TM, Transcendental Meditation, they ended up essentially converting young people from psychedelics to their forms of yoga. Although, you know, Mahesh described TM as not yoga, but essentially it was yoga. It was technologies that use just your body to expand your awareness and focus your mind.
Of course, in the 60s, there was a whole period when psychedelics were essentially all there was. Timothy Leary was maybe the most famous advocate of LSD. And these days, people looking back at that say he's really a cautionary tale, that he oversold it. In some ways, I guess you look at him and you think that maybe he made it almost impossible for scientific study of psychedelics to take place later.
People certainly like to blame him as the reason why scientific research was stalled for so long, and it is understandable. I mean, you have to remember there was a lot of moral panic beyond Leary around psychedelics in the late 60s because it was such a young culture. There were 24 million young Americans by the end of the decade, which was, you know, a huge percentage of the population. And a lot of them, although I think it was probably exaggerated by the media somewhat, but a lot of them, along with a lot of adults, including corporate barons and housewives, were dropping acid and experimenting with magic mushrooms and the like. So it was a great opportunity for people to raise the alarms and insist that this was damaging our youth. And it's a great media story. It's got all the lurid sex, drugs, you know, and rock and roll elements of it. So I do think Leary went too far, and in terms of his own scientific investigations, that's pretty clear. But I would caution people, you know, in terms of blaming him. I think the scientific establishment's pretty conservative, and it was an easy way out.
Yeah. Well, there's the other side of it, too. His colleague, Richard Alpert, you've mentioned, who later changed his name to Ram Dass. He ended up renouncing the use of psychedelics.
Yeah, he basically went to India in 68 with a whole travel kit full of psychedelics, kind of searching for an answer to what they really were. And he had an experience that basically convinced him they weren't necessary anymore. He never fully renounced them as useless. For a period, he basically stopped doing them and was really focused on yoga. But I think he always saw them in moderation as potentially transformative and useful. But he started emphasizing yoga and other non-drug forms of consciousness alteration much more after his trip to India in 68.
Well, that comes back to the whole idea that with personal effort, with study, you can find spirituality and not have to use drugs in order to get it instead of doing study, I guess.
Yes, and this was always the tension with psychedelics, and something that Huxley had been arguing with various spiritual teachers in Los Angeles in the early 50s, which was this sort of notion that spiritual realization requires a lot of effort and hard work, or whether it can happen spontaneously. And most of the spiritual texts, most of the texts around yoga insist that it does require some significant effort. And what's interesting is in the late 60s, when a lot of kids were getting burnt out on drugs, the forms of yoga they were attracted to were the Hare Krishnas or Bhakti Yoga, which is the chanting, and also TM, which is the non-yoga yoga, which is really meditation with a mantra. And those forms are actually easier to learn and can transform your consciousness quite quickly if you're dedicated. And that sort of makes sense because those kids were really used to this kind of quick, almost instant consciousness alteration in, you know, being essentially jacked into these wonderful, blissful states.
Well, and everybody wants the solution now. And it's always easier to look for it in the quickest way than the hardest way.
Right. And as anyone who's practiced yoga knows, it's not a path that's easy or without its obstacles. And I definitely think if you really want to change your consciousness and have those deeper experiences, it can require some serious time and effort and having a good teacher. So it's understandable that the preference for psychedelics and the preference for techniques that seem to do that more quickly. But again, that was sort of what Huxley wrestled with way back in the early 50s. And what Leary and Alpert were kind of experimenting with both at Harvard and then later at Millbrook.
Stephanie Simon was a founder of the web magazine Feed. Her book is The Subtle Body, the story of yoga in America.